Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for May 10th, 2023. The global carbon dioxide level is 424.45 parts per million, which is pretty close to 425 parts per million, which is 75 parts per million higher than where we ought to be, down at that 350 parts per million that science tells us we need to get to. Plus that, there's only 2,436 days left until the year 2030, when we have to cut our emissions. So let's get to work. Today we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I am doing well, and I am really looking forward to our discussion today, where we're going to explore some of the choices and questions we have to think about in our positive view of a sustainable future.
So, Mariah, we started an interesting discussion last time we spoke about, I'm sure everyone who's listening to this podcast caught the earlier podcast, but I'll remind you about what we talked about. We talked about this presentation that we're beginning to see of a stark choice for a future between, and the extremes, you can kind of think of the extremes as a world where all of the fossil fuels are replaced by wind turbines and everything else continues the same, right? And the way I joke is to say that we sit in traffic jams inside of our EVs, but we don't do anything different, right? We just, now we're in an EV and we cook our food with an induction, but we still have terrible inequality. We were still using acre lots to build houses and urban sprawl and all that kind of stuff, right? That's one view. An alternate view is something called, goes by various names, but it's called degrowth is the word, but it's more important is an alternate vision is to say that we need to radically change the economic system and essentially stop pursuing growth, GDP growth, which of course you see on CNN and all, you know, how much did the GDP grow this quarter? That growth is essentially consuming the planet. And we need to stop that as the fundamental reshaping of how we think about the world. Right? So these are kind of two extremes. There's a lot in between. But what popped up over the past week were a couple of concrete examples of where, in the present, we're making decisions about what that future is going to look like and whether or not, how we shape society. All right, Mariah, we talked last week. Is that how you would pose kind of the general question that we're facing here? I just tried to give it, but I think I was not as clear. I mean,
right. Yeah. We've got, you know, like we talked about last week, there's sort of this, you know, we know climate change is a problem that needs to be addressed. And we have this solution spectrum between the words we used last, in our last podcast were the green tinted glasses of sort of endless growth, you know, continuing with business as usual versus the idea of degrowth, you know, radically reshaping our capitalistic society to live within nature's limitations.
The planetary limits. Yeah.
Yeah. The physical limits of the planet.
And so there's a couple of examples I put out there we can kind of poke at. So again, dear listener, there's no clear answer here, right? We're exploring this question ourselves, right? We're facing this thing of how, because what we're really talking about is reshaping capitalism at some level, which is, it's not a fool's errand, right? It is almost an imperative. How are we going to live our lives? The two questions come in the following. One is that there's an article in Time magazine that talks about a site in Nevada. And at this, the details are essentially that there's a site in Nevada which contains a lot of lithium in the ground. And somebody wants to come dig up the ground, get the lithium, and put it into your car battery and make thousands and thousands of car batteries. So now instead of combustion engines, we all have an electric vehicle. What's at stake?
Yeah, it's 370,000 electric vehicles per year. That's how much lithium is in that area.
Right. So it's a fantastic amount, a lot of lithium. You say, oh my God, yeah, let's build all those EVs and save the planet. Flip side is that there is a not very useful weed growing there, but it is an endangered species, right? And so if we dig up all this lithium to have our EVs, we're probably going to kill off this particular buckthorn wheat.
TM's buckwheat.
TM's buckwheat. Okay. So there's this little plant that's going to get killed. And of course, the little plant in and of itself is not so important, but there's representation that we're going to destroy an ecosystem in order to get this lithium. It presents the question, is it worth it? Is your electric vehicle worth it? Right? Is that the direction you want to go as a planet? And the other article is similar. It talks about, the most extreme case is that it makes the case that species, and let's just pick the bison, the buffaloes out west, that they, through various, the way they interact with the soil and the grass and whatnot, they actually consume a lot of carbon and put it in the ground, right? They're very, very effective at transferring carbon dioxide out of the air into the ground. And so they say, oh yeah, what we need is 60 million bison free roaming across the American West, just like the 1860s. And of course you say, yeah, sure, 60 million bison, no one's going to let that happen because everybody owns something out there. Again, you're back to a collision between the planetary limits and what capitalism can accept, right? And so those are just two things. Mariah, what's your take on it? Lead me out of the wilderness here, so to speak.
Well, maybe I'll lead you into the wilderness, right?
That would be a good thing.
The Inside Climate News article was the one about sort of these rewilding zones. It's called Rewilding Parts of the Planet Could Have Big Climate Benefits by Bob Berwin. And, it's compelling, right? I quite frankly like the idea of depending on species to do our carbon sequestration. And I think there's a lot of promise there. You know, one of the things the article suggested is that cattle ranchers could potentially move toward becoming bison ranchers and essentially be, carbon ranchers. So they're going to and make more money than they're making off of their cattle, right? So they're letting these bison, because the bison free range, their hooves dig up the soil. Their grazing causes the different grasses that they eat to have deeper roots, which, then the grasses sequester that carbon. And so they really do a great job of pulling carbon out of the air. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there's all these folks who want their carbon offsets, right? Maybe this becomes a carbon offset, or there's a lot of different ways you could structure the economy to support this kind of, either subsidizing or purchasing outright, in some way supporting this kind of ecosystem where the farmers actually might make more money from a system like this.
My question, though, to challenge that is like, yeah, the farmers can make. So what you're saying is that forget the cows, forget the beef that everybody wants in their hamburger. They should just support these herds of bison, and then they can get carbon credits and they can live there by having this herd of bison. But the flip side of me is like, okay, but again, the bison are reduced to an economic value, right? We're turning everything into money, right? Yeah. And and if it weren't economically valuable, then we wouldn't do it and the planet would burn up.
Yes. By the way, though, you could still have bison burgers. We're not trying to take away your hamburgers.
Interesting.
You can eat those. Excellent. Bison meat is quite delicious.
I've never had bison. My brother has.
Yeah. Is it good? It doesn't taste. I mean, it's maybe a tiny little bit more gamey. I think it's better for your health, right? There's a little less fat in it, but you can go to Whole Foods Market and buy bison burgers. It's more expensive.
And we could go back. Boy, the whole context for me here is like, what does the future look like? Mm. Right. And if you have a rewilded American West where there's 60 million bison running around, presumably cowboys, would they be on horses? Would they be on the all-terrain vehicles?
Yeah.
Which are probably damaging as well, right? But the horses are probably better for the for the turf. And of course, the issue you mentioned, but I just want to repeat it, is like the bison, their hooves dig into the dirt, turn the dirt over, and then it's able to capture more carbon as the stuff grows back from the churned up dirt, right? So, yeah. But I mean,
but they're big and dangerous, right? So there's that too, right? I mean, bison are, they can be territorial, and I mean, they're big. I was, you know, out in Wind Caves National Park a couple summers ago, and we saw them. And I mean, they're magnificent. But I would not want to be in the way of one of those if it was angry.
But it suggests a future, which is at least through the cash cow, I guess the way of making money from the bison, right? You would be rewilding the planet and capturing carbon, which is not the only possible. It's not a silver bullet for carbon capture, but it is a significant contributor, and we need to be doing all this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, they, you know, this idea of rewilding, they call it nature tech, right? In the article, but they say that it can pull down 500 gigatons of carbon dioxide by 2100, which would keep us below the 1.5 degree, you know, target of Celsius target of rising temperatures. So it's not insignificant what we could do with nature tech through all these different approaches. But the question is, you know, it goes back to kind of what we were talking about in the last podcast, you know, is the ecologically necessary going to be politically impossible? And then you go back to this idea of, well, you have to have financial incentive, right? That, you know, you can't just tell the cattle ranchers out, you know, in these big open spaces, sorry, we're taking away your cattle. You have to give them some way to have a lifestyle if you're taking away their cattle.
I mean, the other intriguing thing in that article talked about, beavers, which I think you correctly identified as keystone species, but I guess the beavers chop down the trees, and in and of themselves, they don't consume that much carbon, but they make the dams, when they make the dam, they make a pond, and then there's all kinds of carbon capture associated with the life that goes on around a beaver pond. Right?
So they're engineers.
Yeah. I mean, there are significant ability to capture carbon dioxide back into the ground if you allow the beavers their way. But of course, I mean, even here in my town, there's a state forest, and the beavers are there, but people don't like it because it gets outside of the state forest, and all of a sudden your backyard's flooded and everyone's mad at over. And so you're back to the conflict between private property, growth, money, and a system, you know, this available natural technology to capture carbon. I mean, it's just.
Yeah. I mean, so there's a wonderful ecological economist that I follow a bit of his work. His name's Herman Daly. And he has put forward sort of this idea of sustainability, of a sustainable world, which we're not meeting. But, you know, it's not like we shouldn't touch any of the resources and we should, you know, release anything to the resources. He asserts that what matters is that we don't use resources faster than the earth can replenish those resources, and that we don't release things into the atmosphere that faster than the, you know, or sorry, release things into the ecosystem faster than the ecosystem can purify it. So there is this idea of, you know, if we work within the ecological systems, they are set up to help us continue the things that are essential to our functioning, you know, to having a life that is, you know, comfortable. Although I think that's the big question is, what is a comfortable life? It can vary greatly. And that kind of brings us back to the business as usual sort of approach versus.
I saw a Twitter post. I admit I occasionally go on Twitter, but maybe it was on one of the other newer sites, but basically saying that I think it might've been Denmark where everyone rides their bikes. Or it might have been someplace in the United States where people like the idea of riding, having bikes in the city. But if it affects the way they get around, they're not so crazy about it. Right? So this ecologically sound, let's all ride a bike, which you'd think would be a good thing to do. People don't want to be inconvenienced. And so the natural reaction is to reject these things. And you're back to the question of the conflict between – you know, what people want and what people think they're entitled to and what the planet can sustain.
Right? Yeah. Although I will say, so I was in Copenhagen for a couple of weeks many years ago, but, you know, I remember trying to cross a sidewalk and there, I mean, at a major intersection, and there was like 40 bikes at this stoplight and like four cars. I mean, there were so many bikes in Copenhagen. It was how people got around. And the city was very well designed to accommodate that. And it certainly didn't look like anyone was super bothered to be on their bike, you know, like because the city was set up really well. It was really well designed to support that.
Well, that comes back to the question we have about the, I mean, I'm back to the lithium thing, which for some reason is like a burr under my saddle, so to speak. But I mean, the lithium mine that would be dug out in Nevada would be used to build lots and lots of cars, lots of cars, which would then go back into the city, and you don't break the loop. Somehow, mm-hmm. you say Copenhagen is well laid out to handle bikes, but I mean, somebody made a choice at some point to make that happen. It didn't happen, I don't know, by accident. And so when did cities in the United States begin to do something similar to accept other forms of transportation, mass transit, be it a bike or, you know, electric buses or whatever, to basically break the loop and make that portion of our lives less demanding on the planet? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've got to bring up James Cameron's Avatar, right? Where the movie Avatar, both of them, right? There's the way of the water too. With this whole idea of sort of, you know, the Navi who lived very much within the ecosystem services and their life was not wanting for anything. And they were very much a part of, you know, the circle of life. And then they had the humans coming in and bulldozing everything to get their, you know, to get their whatever it was they needed to run their machines, right? Mm-hmm. Or I guess in the way of the water, it was the, you know, anti-aging serum, right? And sorry, spoiler alert there. but, you know, I think that it's an, for what it's worth, for what the movie was worth, I enjoyed them. They were fun. But I think that that's kind of the question, right? You know, are we capable of sort of having an ecosystem where, I mean, having a lifestyle that exists within the resources that, you know, that exists in a way that we are using the resources sustainably, or are we just too far gone? We're so committed to the, you know, car lifestyle, the urban sprawl, that we can't scale it back.
I mean, I saw something again, it's one of these memes floating around, but it said in a capitalist society, a forest has no value until you cut it down. Mm. Once it's chopped down, then it's got value, right? You can sell the lumber, but until then and I think that it's a question of reshaping how we value things and what we care about. And I suppose it's putting value on, you know, you're back to the bison and the bison ranchers, right? Getting their carbon credits from the ground. I mean, preserving that forest has value, has monetary value. But I mean, who's going to pay it? And do we need to live in a society where that monetization of things is the only thing that makes anything happen?
Well, that even brings up the question of, you know, why does biodiversity matter, right? That one little, you know, that TM's buckwheat that is out in the Rhyolite Ridge in Nevada, you know, Thacker Pass area that has all the lithium. Who cares about that one little, you know, puffy yellow plant? You know, most people would not notice if it was extinct, you know, went the way of the dodo. But you think about the things. So is biodiversity important just because of biodiversity, you know, just for this sort of cycle of life? We don't know, you know, you pick out any, as John Muir says, you pick out any one thing by itself and you find it hitched to everything else in the universe. So, you know, is that why that little, you know, TM's buckwheat matters, because it could be hitched to a whole cycle that we don't fully understand? Or does it matter because, like, there was a, in the 1960s, there was a periwinkle from Madagascar that they figured out could help cure, that they they did use to help fight cancer, right? What if that had gone extinct and we never could have used it to help fight cancer? Is that why biodiversity matters? Because we don't know what we don't know about how it could help humans. And I think that's kind of a, you know, a question that get both sides coming on that one.
Absolutely. I mean, it is. And there's no clear answer, right? I mean, there's advantages to it, but there's also just the sense of awe that that this stuff could engender in you. Just the fact that we're here and the biodiversity exists and what a miracle it all is. And isn't that enough on the face of it to just, you know, think twice before you kill the last dodo bird, right?
Right. Yeah, these are all tough questions, which we don't have the answer to, but we're good at asking.
Yeah, well, and I think you can't get an answer until you ask a question. So I think the exercise here has been to begin to wonder, right? Nibble at the edges of what it's going to look like, what things even matter, what should we be talking about? And I suspect that there's other issues that come up as we go along. I mean, because again, climate touches everything. There'll be 1,000 ways that there will be conflicts between cutting carbon dioxide emissions and something else, right? Or there'll be choices. But the more conscious we are of the fact that we're making choices as we do these things and more conscious of what the stakes are, I think we're better off, right?
Yeah, I agree.
All right. Well, what we'll do is we'll put up links to the articles that we had, and probably I'll throw in some of them. We've had, Mariah and I have had multiple podcasts on lithium, right? So, you know, what's going on in the lithium world? We just got done talking about a high-tech solution for taking carbon dioxide out of the air with, you know, paint with algae in it. You know, that's a far cry from saving the beavers so they can make beaver dams, right? We had a podcast recently with an author about ways to envision the future. So there's lots of, I would say, intellectual foment around this, lots of questions. And it's an interesting topic. I hope, dear listener, that you find it entertaining to think about. I hope that you think about it offline because, I mean, where we're headed is something that we can't just let happen by chance because because that's not a good recipe. Anyhow, there you go. We'll put those links on the blog at massclimateaction.org/blog. You know how to get there now. You look for the newsletter, more in the banner, pull down, look for the blog and podcast on the menu. If you have comments or questions, send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what we ought to be talking about. To that end, we want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research to provide us with interesting topics all the time. You're probably listening to this show on your smartphone using one of the modern podcast distribution apps. Please rate us. Please, you know, it helps us in the standings. While you're thinking about MCAN, please go to the MCAN website and donate to MCAN. You can do that. No one's going to stop you. And it's pretty easy. One button and you're in. So we'll close where we always close by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. We have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next 7 years under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, advice, investments, and a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities. Well, Mariah, thank you for this interesting philosophical discussion. I'm sure it's the first of many.
It is a pleasure to discuss and think about these things with you.
Great. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.